Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 87, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, April 27, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
We have to understand the causal mechanisms that make ordinary good people do bad things. We have to develop a public health model, not the old medical model. The public health model says when we look at individuals who are afflicted with a disease, we look for the vector of disease. We look for where the epidemic is coming from, because then we can inoculate people against it. If all we do is treat the individuals with medicine or with prison, you never change the cause of evil.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Philip Zimbardo, who is internationally recognized as a leading voice and face of contemporary psychology through his widely seen PBS TV series, Discovering Psychology, his media appearances, best-selling trade books on shyness, and his classic research, The Stanford Prison Experiment. He's been a Stanford University professor since 1968, and now he's an emeritus professor, much like myself. Having taught previously at Yale, NYU, and Columbia University, he continues teaching graduate students at the Pacific Graduate School of Psychology and at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's been given numerous awards and honors as an educator, researcher, writer, and for service to the profession. Recently, he was awarded the Havel Foundation Prize for his lifetime of research on the human condition. Among his more than 300 professional publications and 50 books is the oldest current textbook in psychology, Psychology and Life, now in its 18th edition, and Core Concepts in Psychology in its 15th edition. His current research interests continue in the domain of social psychology, with a broad emphasis on everything interesting to study, from shyness to time perspective, madness, cults, vandalism, political psychology, torture, terrorism, and evil. Noted for his personal and professional efforts to give psychology away to the public, Zimbardo has also been a social political activist, challenging the government's wars in Vietnam and Iraq, as well as the American correctional system. Zimbardo has served as elected president of the Western Psychological Association twice, and he's also been president of the American Psychological Association, as well as chair of the Council of Scientific Society Presidents, representing 63 scientific, math, and technical associations with 1.5 million members, and he's now chair of the Western Psychological Foundation. He heads a philanthropic foundation in his name to promote education in his ancestral Sicilian towns. Zimbardo adds to his retirement list activities serving as the new executive director of a center on terrorism, the Center for Interdisciplinary Policy, Education, and Research on Terrorism. He is most excited by the publication of his most recent contribution, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, and it's put out by Random House just this year, 2007. I'm very excited to bring you the following interview. Dr. Philip Zimbardo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
I'm happy to be here, David.
Okay, well, I'm sure happy to have you here. Now, you've long worked at giving psychology away, and that's what I'm trying to do here with this show as well. So I really appreciate your taking time to speak with me here.
Yeah, it's, I guess my whole career in psychology has been an effort to give back, you know, the gifts that I got. I mean, nobody in my family had ever gone to high school, let alone college. And so education for me was the key of, you know, getting out of the ghetto and surviving. And so my sense has always been that I have to pay back to society, and especially to psychology, which has been so good to me, whatever it is that we've learned that's valuable, you know, to other people.
Well, you've certainly done that in spades, I must say. Now, you've got a new book out called The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. What is it that led you to write that book?
Well, I mean, in one sense, it's been incubating since I was a little kid. I grew up in the South Bronx, New York, and that is maybe always will be a ghetto. It went through various periods where it was a kind of peaceful ghetto and then a violent ghetto when drugs came in. But it meant that I was surrounded by good kids who did bad things, and many of them ended up in prison. Many of them ended up, you know, broken. And so as a kid, I just wondered, you know, what was that transformation? You know, one day they're good, and the next day they're doing terrible things. When I got to be a psychologist, then I was able to reframe the question as, to what extent are ordinary people changed, transformed by different situations that they live in, they exist in, what psychologists call the behavioral context. And so the Lucifer Effect really is a kind of summary of my observations, insights, my Stanford Prison Experiment, and lots of other psychological science done by colleagues, all of which points to the fact that situations are much more powerful in influencing how we think, how we perceive the world, and what we do than we give them credit for. We tend to over-represent the individual dignity, individual willpower, individual rationality in guiding our actions. We put too much stuff in the person and not enough stuff in the situation.
Yeah.
So the Lucifer Effect is an attempt to correct that.
Yes, and your work certainly has been pioneering in that realm. You're a social psychologist by background, I believe, and it seems to me that social psychologists seem to come up with the most ingenious experiments. I think of Stanley Milgram's work, of your work, is it Richie Davidson who did 6 degrees of separation? Is that the right person?
No, it was originally Stanley Milgram also.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was also him where he called the lost letter technique, that he had letters, you know, with names on them, and essentially it was to find out, you know, how many contacts would it take before, you know, somebody who saw this letter would get it to the right person. Social psychologists, I think it's two things. Social psychologists in general tend to believe that situations are important. Social psychologists in general have tended to be more from minority backgrounds, Jewish backgrounds, not mainstream. And so I think as a group, we tend to focus on, you know, how we and our families and our clan have been changed by the situations we're in. And so because we are sensitive to situations, then our research is all about how we manipulate situations to influence people. So the famous research by Leon Festinger, by Elliot Aronson, all had a kind of creative flair, creative twist to it.
Yes, that's really true. Now, we're going to be talking in some detail about the experiment that you're best known for, the Stanford Prison Experiment. Did that build at all on the work of Stanley Milgram? Is that what sort of gave you the idea in the first place?
Only a very general sense. I should tell your listeners a remarkable curiosity is that little Stanley Milgram and I were in the same high school class at James Monroe High School in the Bronx.
Oh my goodness!
In senior year, and in fact, I have a wonderful website, lucereffect.com, and I went back and I found our high school yearbook pictures. So it says about Phil Zimbardo, and then there's a photo gallery, and there's the pictures in our high school class. Well, Stanley, back in 1963, was the first one to do this truly impressive study where he created a situation in which he put ordinary people, 1,000 people from New Haven, Connecticut, Bridgeport, Connecticut, not college students, not high school students, but ordinary, everyday people. And what he showed was that in a matter of less than an hour, he could get the majority, two-thirds or more of these good people, shocking an innocent person, in quote, nearly to death. That is the full range of 450 volts, where this guy is screaming, he may be unconscious, and they go all the way to the very end. And so that study was the first that pushed the limits of situational power. He called it blind obedience to authority, and it's really one of the most generalizable studies in all of psychology.
Yes.
For two reasons. He had a huge sample of 1,000. They were ordinary citizens. And actually, he didn't run one study because he had 1,000 people. He ran 16 different variations. And each one, he varied one element of the situation. So one study was with women, also got two-thirds conformity. If you want to eliminate blind obedience authority, if you first see somebody like you resist, you resist. If you see somebody like you go all the way, then you go all the way. You get up. So he makes it, he shows that you quantify evil. You get down to zero. Other people rebel, you rebel. Other people go all the way, then 90% go all the way.
Yeah, boy, I just learned a lot in what you said. I thought I knew something about that study, but I didn't realize that he had so many subjects, ultimately. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, what I did, David, is when I was writing The Lucifer Effect, I decided to do it, to go back, and as if it was my graduate student thesis. I went back and I literally reread all the original Stanley Milgram work, all the work that people had written about him, and all the follow-up. And all of that is in a whole chapter in The Lucifer Effect. And I just discovered lots of things that we had all gotten wrong. So, for example, the famous white lab coat that the experimenter wore as a symbol of authority was gray.
Oh.
It wasn't white. And Milgram says in a footnote, I didn't want to make it white because white lab coats are associated with medical, and I didn't want this. I didn't want to have the medical authority. The other nice thing about the Lucifer Effect, it has lots of little gems. I have 50 pages of notes.
Oh,
every
I know.
I make a document.
I know. I've been reading in it, and it's quite a tome. So I wasn't able to read the whole thing before the interview.
No. I don't think I've read it all.
I've been grazing in it. I need to hasten to clarify. You mentioned the 450 volts, and just in case there's a listener who has not heard of this very famous study, the person being shocked was a Confederate, and in fact was not being shocked, but was acting like they were. But the subject who was administering these shocks was under the impression that in fact they were electrocuting someone.
Yeah, the vast majority fully believe that when they press that button on this, there's a shock generator with 30 switches starting very low, 15 volts, ending at 450. The vast majority of participants, ordinary citizens, believe that in fact, when they delivered the shock, the guy in the other room was receiving it. It was all pre-programmed. You know, he's yelling and screaming, but obviously in order to keep the experiment consistent over all those participants, it was all tape recorded. So you press a button, you heard the guy scream, but it was tape recorded and constant from person to person.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so back to my question, to what extent was your Stanford prison experiment influenced by Milgram's work on obedience to authority?
It was to the extent that Milgram demonstrated in an interesting context that ordinary people could be seduced to behave in, if you will, evil ways or bad ways. But the way I built on that, I say, although it's very important, it's rare that you have an authority figure directly putting pressure on you to do something bad.
Mm-hmm.
More often, we are in institutions, in families, in schools, in prisons, in hospitals, in old age homes, where nobody's telling you to do something bad, but they are just creating, they're giving you permission to do certain things, or they're looking the other way, or they're hinting at something they'd like to have happen. And so the Stanford Prison Study is about institutions. It's about the power of institutions, about institutional rules and what we call social norms, often unwritten rules, guidelines for behavior, how they can initiate good people into first doing things which are bad, illegal, immoral.
Okay, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty here of this Stanford Prison Experiment study that you did in 1971. Take us through it with as much loving detail as you care to give it.
Sure. The Stanford Prison Study was done way back in 1971. And what is important for your listeners who are younger, the old-timers will remember that 1971 was a volatile era in America. It was civil rights going on, anti-war activism against the Vietnam War, women's liberation coming in, Black Pride and Black Panthers out here in the West Coast. There's college students who formed the Weather Underground, who were blowing up buildings around the country. So it was a time of great civil unrest, great energy. It was a time when young people said, never trust anybody over 30, never trust the military-industrial complex. Everybody had hair. Remember this famous musical Hair?
Sure.
And so these were the students that responded to the ad I put in the city newspaper, wanted subjects and students for study of prison life for 2 weeks, $15 a day. And so when they come in, we interview them, we give them a battery of 5 different psychological tests, because we want to pick kids who are normal and healthy, no history of crime, drug addiction, no psychological emotional problems. And so we start with, of 75 who answer the ad, we start with 24 normal and healthy in every way. But these are kids who say, I don't want to be a guard, ending up at college to become a guard, I'm not a redneck. So that's really important. So the bias is against, becoming a guard.
Mm-hmm.
But then we randomly assign them by a flip of the coin, half a guards, half a prisoners. The guards we have come down the day before, we have them select their own military uniforms, we give them symbols of power, billy clubs, whistles, handcuffs. We have them all wear silver-reflecting sunglasses, an idea I got from the prison movie Cool Hand Luke.
I love that movie.
Create a sense of anonymity.
Yeah.
The prisoners, we simply said, wait in the dormitories, wait at home. The study will begin on Sunday. Unbeknownst to them, I had arranged with the Palo Alto City Police to do realistic arrests with a SWAT car, with the sirens wailing, picking up the kids, charging them with violation of Penal Code 459, PC, armed robbery, breaking and entering, handcuff them, put them against the squad car, read them their rights, neighbors are looking around, and then bring them down to the real city hall, police department, do fingerprinting, photograph, booking them, put a blindfold on, put them in a real prison cell.
Mm.
And then my assistants, Craig Haney, Kurt Banks, would pick them up, bring them to our jail. They're still blindfolded. They don't know where they are. And then strip them naked, delouse them. Presumably they're bringing lice in. They go through a degradation ritual. And then they're standing there in front of a mirror, naked, with everybody laughing at them. And then the study begins. We give them a...
Now, are these all males?
Excuse me?
Are these all men, all male?
Yeah, all male. It's about men. It's all male prison, all men, guards, and prisoners.
Okay.
We actually had done a pretest with mixed sex, mixed genders, and there were problems that I wanted to avoid. For example, one of the female prisoners told the guard, if you let me out, I'll let you do anything you want.
Mm.
And I could have lost my job had he done anything he wanted.
Right.
So we just want to simplify this. Let's just deal with all men.
Okay.
And then the study began with two groups of kids playing a game, cops and robbers, in what they knew was an experiment. And on the first day, nothing happened. I was going to literally end the study on the second day because, the kids playing the role of guards were really awkward. They didn't want to be a guard. It was awkward. They're saying, come on, line up, stop laughing, you do push-ups. And then the next morning, the prisoners rebelled. Even though the guards were hassling them only minimally, it was too much. Again, it was a time of everybody wants personal freedom. So they rebelled, they all had numbers on their uniform, took the numbers off, started cursing the guards, barricaded themselves in the prison cells. And what happened was the guards came to me and said, what are we going to do? I said, it's your prison, your decision. And so they called in all the other guards. There was three guards on each of three shifts, and then with backup guards. And there were three prisoners in each of three cells with backup prisoners. And they came in and broke the rebellion. They broke down the doors. They dragged the prisoners out. They stripped them naked. They chained them. They threw in solitary confinement. And at that point, they said, these are dangerous prisoners. So that transformed the thinking. And then the next thing they said, everything except breathing air is a privilege. Food is a privilege. Bedding is a privilege. Reading is a privilege, et cetera, et cetera. And that changed the whole dynamic. Then it became, as one of the prisoners said, it was a prison run by psychologists and not by the state.
And so, but then things began to go very wrong at some point, as I recall.
Yeah, what happens is that you know, guards are working 8-hour shifts. And so what that means is it gets boring. And the only thing you have is prisoners as playthings. So boredom is a major motivation for evil, major motivation for doing things that are arousing to break through the boredom.
Interesting.
And so we would see over time what I would call creative evil. The guards would think of interesting things to do with the prisoners. So they spent a lot of time having prisoners line up to memorize the rules, and then they'd have to say the rules backwards, then they memorize their numbers, they have to sing their numbers. They'd all do push-ups while somebody's reciting the numbers. Essentially what they did is they created a totally arbitrary environment where the prisoners could not figure out what they would do that would lead to reward or punishment. So a guard would tell a joke, prisoners would laugh, they got punished. A guard would tell a joke, they wouldn't laugh, prisoners got punished. And so it was creating this arbitrary environment which really fostered what Marty Seligman has called learned helplessness.
Yes.
And that's why in 36 hours we saw the first prisoner have an emotional breakdown, screaming, out of control, crying, and we had to release him to student health. And each day after that, that became the model of how you exit, how you escape from this increasingly hostile environment.
Were they just acting like they were upset, or were they truly beginning to break down?
Well, the evidence we had is that the first kid started out acting. That is, the first kid started out saying, you know, this is the way I'm going to get out. And then, you know, because we interviewed him at great length afterwards, he got so into it and he was so upset there was a little of the paranoid element. He had to now act this way in front of his cellmates because they're three to a cell. And that in a funny sense, the madness took over him. And that when he is screaming, when he is out of control, and you listen to those tapes, they're just chilling, he became, I guess the most mild phrase is, severely emotionally disturbed, distressed. I mean, so much so that we had to release him. I mean, it's an experiment. In a real prison, you would just send him to sick bay or something of this kind. But an interesting sidelight is this young man. It had such a big impact on him. So that's why we know he wasn't just play acting. It changed his whole life. He went on to get a PhD in clinical psychology at Berkeley. He did his dissertation on the shame of prisoners and the guilt of guards. Did his internship in San Quentin and has been working in a San Francisco County jail for the past 20 years.
Amazing.
And so if it's play acting, it's play acting that he very deeply internalized.
I'll say. Now, what about the guards? Was there a psychological impact on them?
Yeah, well, I should say, so we had to end the study after 6 days for several reasons. One of them was that what you got was increasing levels of homophobia. I mean, stripping prisoners naked, laughing at their genitals, playing games that at first started having a sexual component, like one prisoner is Frankenstein, one is Mrs. Frankenstein, pushing them together, say you love them, and then it escalates more and more. saying, you know, F that hole in the ground. And then finally, your female camels bend over, your male camels get behind them, and now start humping them. And the guards are laughing because humping is a play on words, mm-hmm. a double entendre. Mm. But the prisoners are simulating sodomy. In a psychological study of cops and robbers, where it's all fake, it's not a real prison, you know, there's nobody with guns forcing you to do that, and they are now mindlessly obeying every order of the guards. And at this point, you know, the study is out of control, or you could say we proved the point. Situations can overwhelm disposition. Situations can overwhelm personal character. Not of everybody, but of most people.
Okay, how did you not lose your job over that?
Well, it was 1971. If it was, you know, because people said, oh, you must have been sued. No, in 1971, we did not have a litigious society. There was not a lawsuit. There was not anything negative at all. And in fact, you know, the study was approved by the Stanford Human Subjects Committee. And see, what you have to realize is it's a different evaluation after the fact than before. I mean, after I tell you all of this, you say, wow, that study never should have been done. What was the Human Subjects Committee thinking? The Human Subjects Committee was thinking, here's kids playing cops and robbers in an experiment. If it gets out of hand, they walk away, they quit. It's not a prison, it's an experiment. And in fact, that's what we all thought. But the prisoners transformed it. It was a prisoner who told the others, they won't let you leave, you can't quit. We never said that, of course. But once they said that, then it became a realistic prison. We had prison chaplain come down, interviewed the prisoners, and he's there knowing it's an experiment. In fact, he wanted some references. I said, I'll trade you. I'll give you references for your term paper if you come down, interview the prisoners, give me a sense of how realistic it is. He drops into his prison role, and he says, what are you doing to get out, son? For each of the kids, they said, what? He said, you're in jail. You need a lawyer to get out. And they're looking at him dumbfounded. What do you mean? I thought this was an experiment. So he made them think it was really an experiment. I mean, really a jail, not an experiment. And one of the kids said, well, my cousin's a public defender. And he said, well, you want me to contact him? The lawyer then contacts this kid's mother, say, your son is in jail. Bring down your cousin, the public defender, to help get him out.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's either written by Pirandello or Kafka. I'm not sure which.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, so it was all of these little things which were unique that transformed this, what started out as a little demonstration of the power of the situation into something totally unexpected and huge.
Yes, and something that you didn't expect when you set this whole thing in motion. That nobody could have anticipated it, and that's why this is such a landmark study, is because it really revealed a dynamic, you know, the power of the situation that I don't think was understood prior to this.
Yeah, in a funny way, as you say this, I never had a thought. It's really you're going to put together a drama, a dramatic presentation, but it ends up not having a final act. That the actors keep acting, the audience leaves, and the actors keep doing their role. And you say, wait a minute, no, it's supposed to end now. And they're saying, no, and what? You know, that is, that they take what started out as being acting on a stage with props and costumes and scenery, and then it becomes something totally different. It's as if the actors are doing method acting, and the method becomes the madness.
Mm-hmm. I'm still wondering about the psychological... is there a phone in the background?
Wait, excuse me. Let me get away from my phone. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm still wondering about the psychological impact on the guards. You described the kind of homophobic activities that they got involved in. Was there any sense of shame or remorse afterwards?
It varied enormously. I should say, you know, there's no question it was unethical in the sense that people suffered. In the Milgram study, when it's all over, the victim comes out and says, hey, you didn't shock me, we were just pretending. Many of the people still felt guilt because you knew, you thought you had shocked them. Here, people really suffered. They suffered not for 50 minutes, as in most studies, but day in and day out. So when it was all, and I am responsible for that, and in the Lucifer Effect, I have a long section on, half a chapter on the ethics of this research, mm-hmm. you know, and my continued apology to to having created it and not ending it sooner. But what we did at the end of the study is we first had extensive debriefing with all the guards, then separately all the prisoners, then we brought the guards and prisoners together. And during that time, what I was able to say is, look, we all did bad things. Me as a superintendent, you as guards, you as prisoners. But, you know, it is diagnostic of the power of this strange situation that we've all been in. It's not diagnostic of our personality. It's not diagnostic of any pathology in us. Because I chose you because you were the best and brightest. And in my own case, I have a whole history of being a caring, loving teacher, father, et cetera, et cetera. But in this time and this place, I was transformed into become a cold-hearted superintendent. And you were transformed into becoming creatively evil guards, and you were transformed to becoming pathological prisoners. The ones who didn't break down became zombies, doing anything the guards would say, spit in this guy's face, call him a bastard, and they said, yes, sir, and they did it. Mm-hmm. So then I said, all of us, you know, did things that we are ashamed of, but it tells us the message that situations can be much more powerful than we ever thought. I had them all come back 2 weeks later, where we then showed them the videotapes we made, and then I guess 2 months later there was a video made of NBC made a video of the Stanford Prison Study, and many of them came back. I've been in contact with some of them for 35 years, but again they vary. So, you know, some of them still justify what they did in various ways.
Interesting,
but it did not have as negative an impact on the prisons or guards as you might assume just from hearing that they really suffered, because they were because they had the normal healthy foundation to bounce back to, and also because the bizarre behavior, the evil behavior, was so specific to wearing a uniform in that dungeon at that time, that place. So you take off the uniform, get them out of the place, and it's exactly what happened with Eichmann in Auschwitz. Normal before you put him in, you give him this job to execute 2 million Jews in 3 months. He's a monster. You take him out, you put him on trial, and Hannah Arendt says he's terrifyingly normal.
Now, given the changes in the American Psychological Association ethical guidelines, could you conduct a study like this today?
You can't even ask questions that would be imagined to be distressing to participants. That it's not possible to do any kind of behavioral research which involves deception, which involves stress to the individuals, that the human subject committees are exceedingly cautious, if you will, exceedingly conservative, to prevent any kind of unnecessary arousal or distress. And some people, like me, would say the pendulum has swung too far in the other way.
I was wondering if you would feel that way.
Yeah, see, I mean, the issue is really that, of course, human subjects or human participants or animal participants have to be protected from excesses of experimental power. There's no question about that. On the other hand, in the extreme, you do no research. That if all the research is only about pablum, you're never going to find out what is the effect of poison on the system. So that you can't study, you know, how people. Suppose you want to do a study of resilience. Suppose you want to do a study to find out who's going to be the hero in certain kind of situations. Well, you can't create the situation from which people can show their resilience from, or show their leadership to overcome or change. And so it puts psychology or social science in a bind to say, if indeed you have to be in some situations to understand how powerful they can be, but now we can't ever allow you to create those situations, we're only going to ask people to imagine how they would behave if you were a guard in the following prison, you know, then you have a distorted psychology or distorted sense of what people are and what they can do.
I certainly agree with you. The world would be much poorer without the research that you and Stanley Milgram did. I mean, it opened up a whole new way of understanding what goes on. In fact, let's leap forward then to what I suspect was one of the driving motivations for writing this book, which is Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you see, the same, I mean, obviously, it's many, many years. I've written a number of different articles about Stanford Prison Study, many of them with Craig Haney, who was my graduate student then, is now a professor of law and psychology at Santa Cruz. And we've written lots of studies, lots of articles and chapters about the book, but essentially we laid it to rest until literally it's almost 3 years, April 28, 2004, when we were all shocked by those horrendous pictures coming out of a strange place called Abu Ghraib prison of American soldiers dehumanizing, degrading, crushing prisoners they were supposed to be protecting in this prison. And I was shocked, but I was in surprise because I had seen those images, guards stripping prisoners naked, guards putting bags over their heads, guards sexually degrading prisoners. That was my guards 35 years ago down in the basement at Stanford. And so the military comes on immediately and says, don't blame the military. It's a few bad apples. It's a few rogue soldiers. Our good President Bush comes on and says, we're going to get to the bottom of this, which parenthetically means we're never going to get to the top of it, right? Well, you know, I make the argument is that maybe these are not bad apples. Maybe it was the barrel that was bad. Maybe these are good American soldiers, as most American soldiers are when they start out, and we put them in a bad barrel of prison, and we put that bad barrel in a bad barrel of war. So it's a doubly corrupting barrel. Well, the good thing for me was that a lawyer for one of these guards heard me on NPR and invited me to be on his defense team. And on the defense team for Sergeant Chip Frederick, he was a sergeant supposedly in charge of that night shift, I got access to all the information about him so I could determine, was he a good apple or a bad apple to start with? And then all the information about what was that situation like, that behavioral context, that all these soldiers did these bad things. And then I was able to ask the big question, who created that situation that put these young men and women in harm's way? And then the answer is, it's the system. And I have a whole chapter in the Lucifer where I track down, like an investigative reporter, who are the colonels, who are the generals that put the system in charge, and then what was Rumsfeld's role in propagating a set of 8 specific interrogation tactics which migrated from Guantanamo Bay down to this dungeon in Tijuana, Abu Ghraib. And so I put all these people on trial.
Were you able to, in terms of the real trial that was going on, were you able to prevail at all?
Oh, not at all. I mean, you know, the military justice is a strange thing. Some people would say it's an oxymoron, it was all set. I mean, these are show trials. What they do is they give some outlandish sentence, like the guy I defended was going to get 15 years, and then you plea bargain that you're going to rat on the other soldiers, they take a few years off, you're going to agree to this charge in place of a more profound charge. And so I think he was going to get 9 years, and maybe my situationist argument reduced it by a year at most. So he got 8 years, a dishonorable discharge, 8 years in prison. They sent him to solitary confinement. They took away 9 medals. This guy is a super patriot. He should have been the poster boy for the military. He loves the American flag. He's from, you know, a small town in Virginia. He was a guard in a minimum security prison. Now he's in charge of 1,000 prisoners, 60 Iraqi policemen who are smuggling weapons in, and he's overwhelmed. And he's an Army reservist. He's a weekend soldier with no training for this. Well, and then they took away 22 years of his retirement pay. He had been in the National Guard. I mean, so he's broken. And he said, I'm guilty. You know, I'm willing to serve. I'm willing to die for my country. The sentence is way out of proportion to anything that he did specifically. But it was the trophy photos. It was those images of American soldiers degrading, dehumanizing prisoners, which we had never seen before. And so it was the humiliation of the military and the humiliation of the Bush administration that he had to pay for.
So in some, that's got to have been heartbreaking for you. I'm sure it continues to be, you know, knowing what you know about this young man and your close involvement with him. And it seems like in some ways we haven't learned the lesson of this research.
Oh, not at all. It's very sad. I mean, I must say that the single thing that was most enlightening to me, and I lay this out, I guess, in Chapter 15 of The Lucifer Effect, is that one of the investigations, there have been 11 investigations into these abuses, 10 of the 11 are by generals. They're called independent investigations, but it doesn't make sense. They're all by generals. Where was the Senate Armed Service Committee? Why didn't they do one? Well, they didn't do one because they were pushed to the side. But one of these is by former Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger. And in it, he says explicitly what you just hinted at, that the landmark Stanford study should have been a cautionary tale to the military about the potential for abuse of detainees in a prison setting. And then he goes on to say, and the Stanford setting was benign compared to the stress of wartime. He said it should have been a cautionary tale to require greater planning, greater attention to training, which, of course, never was done. So he outlines it, and he said the principles of social psychology could have predicted what happened in this place at that time. So in a way, it's kind of a backhanded compliment for the Stanford Prison Study for social psychology, but it's after the fact.
Yeah, you know, I think that your book needs a film, kind of like Al Gore's film, to get the word out there, because it is, your book is, it's long, it's wonderfully written, it's both scholarly and informal. Somehow you've managed to marry those two elements together, I would love to see it get a much wider readership or to have the basic message disseminated much more widely.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in the baby Al Gore stage. I mean, obviously, I give lectures. I've given 10 lectures in the last month, and I have a whole lecture on the Lucifer Effect, you know, with slides and video clips and things. I don't know how to make it into a movie, but I think you're right. It's the message has to go to the next level. Because not, you know, relatively few people in our society read books, certainly not big fat books.
Right. You know, something that you said touches on another issue relating to the American Psychological Association's ethics guidelines, which it's very controversial. Currently, as they're written, they allow psychologists to work as consultants in places such as Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and some psychologists are upset, feeling that we shouldn't get near such places and should have the stricter guidelines that the American Psychiatric Association put out. Where are you on that issue?
Yeah, it's very contentious. Actually, at the American Psychological Meeting here in San Francisco in August, there's going to be about 10 or 12 hours devoted to just that issue. What is the role of psychologists in these interrogations? And there's a wide range of opinion. Obviously, the American Psychological Association has come down, you know, on the soft side, that is, saying, you know, yes, it's okay for psychologists to be involved in various ways. You know, the government says we don't torture, so psychologists say, well, we're not involved in torture. I wrote an extended commentary about it to say that number one, the committee that was put together to review these issues was biased from the start. Of 10 people on the committee, 6 had Department of Defense connections. Several were in the military. Mm. Well, before you begin, you know you're in trouble because they have to approve of the restricted Bush's interpretation and not the international standard of we will do nothing that violates the human dignity. We'll do nothing that involves cruelty or personal dignity. We will do nothing. We will not uphold the Geneva standards. We're going to uphold the Bush standard. You know, so that alone cast the whole conclusion in a very negative light. In fact, there's likely to be a major expose in Vanity Fair coming out in the next month or two, which goes to the bottom of, you know, how did that happen? How did you have a committee dealing with ethics when it was set up so badly, so in such a biased way? And
it's,
I think it's going to be very explosive for psychology.
Yes, yeah, it's brewing. A storm is a brewing.
Yeah, it'll be sad because it's going to. What's sad is it may have negative backlash about psychology, and not just the particular people who did this wrongdoing, who
yes.
set up this commission improperly in order to give support for the Bush's interpretation of unlawful enemy noncombatants. Or why we have to suspend the Geneva Convention.
Yeah. Well, the committee aside and how it was formed, I mean, one side is saying you need to have psychologists somewhere in the process because they can help temper it, they can help keep it humane, they can maybe be aware of what I'll refer to as, I was going to call it the Zimbardo effect, but I'll call it the Lucifer effect. And so they could maybe temper things. On the opposite side, you have people who say psychologists shouldn't be anywhere near this sort of situation, and they're concerned about what you might call behavioral drift, that
right.
they will be influenced by the environment, by the military environment context in which they find themselves, and they will become
oh, yeah.
victims, in fact, of the Lucifer effect. So where do you come down on that?
I
don't know where I do, actually. I'm sort of split.
Well, see, I mean, it would be nice if the first part, you know, of your statement were true, is that if psychologists were there as neutral observers giving advice to the military about what we know in general about persuasion, about compliance, but, you know, as representatives of humanity, that we would say that's going too far or that that's not acceptable. The problem is, most of the psychologists there work for the military. That is, they have a job to do. They are sucked in. It's more than behavioral drift. It's that, you know, if you are a captain military psychologist and the colonel is doing something wrong, you cannot say you are doing something wrong, sir, without having your career jeopardized. So it's really a phony dichotomy. It's that when you are in that situation, psychologists have very little power. Very little power. Certainly if they're in the military and if they're outranked, somebody says, shut up, do your job, or go away. Or we'll get somebody else to do it. So I think it's too idealistic to say psychologists can be good because we can moderate against excesses. When you're embedded in the situation, you become part of the excess. Or you begin to change your values so that you don't see it as excess. You see it as necessary in the war on terrorism.
Okay, I appreciate your being so clear about that. We've just recently had this experience of mass killings at Virginia Tech, and I know your career has involved a lot of focus on the study of violence. Do you think our society is becoming more violent than in the past? And if so, why?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I was in London when this happened last week, which was probably fortunate. Otherwise, I would have had to give commentary on endless TV programs.
Right.
But even in London, it was on BBC, CNN all the time. You know, and there were these horrific programs on getting into the mind of the mad killer. But what was upsetting to me is here is this rush to the dispositional that immediately say, we need to know everything there is to know about this crazy kid, this lunatic. How could anybody have done such a horrific thing? On and on. So it's what the Lucifer effect is opposing is to say, yes, people do behavior. Yes, people are the actors who carry out behavior. Yes, psychology is the scientific study of the behavior and mental process of individuals, but people always are in a behavioral context. And if you don't ask about the behavioral context, you rarely understand the causes. So if this Virginia Tech thing was the first one, then yeah, let's find out about the person. It's the 11th school shooting in a decade. So then I say, well, is there a pattern? Is this kid simply one of many who what he did is noteworthy only because it's the biggest? It's 32, and that's more than we had before. If it was only 11, it would have made such a big deal. But well, we see what? He's shy. He's a loner. He was bullied. He was teased. He never had a friend. He sent out messages over and over again, I need help, and he got none. And what he did get was a gun. He got a gun. He got a semi-automatic gun, which would have been illegal had the law not been retroactively changed. So that, you know, after Columbine, there was some minimal restriction. You can't have an automatic rifle with a cartridge with fewer than 11 bullets or something. Well, the National Rifle Association puts pressure on Congress, and they take that law away. So this kid had a gun that had a cartridge with 15 bullets, and he could shoot that many people in one pulling one trigger. So here's what I'm saying, is that it's shyness, being lonely, being alienated, being teased, being bullied. These are the situational circumstances that could have prevented this. These are the same things that happen in Columbine, in almost all the shootings. And I actually have done research when I used to do work on shyness to say that when I looked at young men who had recently committed a homicide, for the first time in their life they broke the law, they killed somebody, 80% of them were shy. And I looked at other men who had recently also killed somebody, had a whole history of crime, almost none of them were shy. If you are shy, it means you have not learned to verbally negotiate conflicts, and you just become sullen, you get depressed, you turn it inward, you commit suicide, but now if you have a gun, you get angry, and you turn it outward, and you kill. And you know how many shy, lonely, alienated kids are out there, especially kids from minority immigrant backgrounds, and it's not just in America, it's everywhere. So my concern is, you know, save your tissues, save your crying towel. This is going to happen again and again and again, because we're not dealing with symptoms. We're dealing with, the person. If this kid had not killed himself, you know, if he was there, he could have been lynched. Certainly, if he was black or Muslim, he would have been lynched, or imprisoned, tormented, etc. But the whole point of my book, The Lucifer Effect, is we have to understand the causal mechanisms that make ordinary good people do bad things. We have to develop a public health model, not the old medical model. The public health model says when we look at individuals who are afflicted with a disease, we look for the vector of disease. We look for where the epidemic is coming from, because then we can inoculate people against it. If all we do is treat the individuals with medicine or with prison, you never change the cause of evil.
And that, I think, is a good place for us to wrap it up. So, Dr. Philip Zimbardo, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I really appreciate it. And do have your listeners go to LucerEffect.com. I think they're going to see something rather remarkable there.
Yes,
it's all free and it's all downloadable.
Great. And I will put a link to that in my show notes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, I have to tell you, it was really a thrill to me to be able to interview someone of Dr. Zimbardo's stature in the field of psychology. I know you will have found this to be as interesting and as educational as I did. As much as the research of both Milgram and Zimbardo underscore the power of situational forces to get normal people like you and me, presumably, to do evil things, in both studies, there were people who were the exception, people who refused to go along. So the really interesting question is, what's unique about those people, and how can we inoculate people so that they don't get caught up in these kinds of situational dynamics? And that's a question that I meant to put to Dr. Zimbardo, and skipped over it. We didn't get around to it. And the question would have been, not everyone gives in to the situational forces. What do we know about those who resist? Now, in fact, he takes this issue up in his book, and he outlines a 10-step program for resisting influence. And let me just see if I can hit the highlights of those. The first is to be willing to say to yourself, I made a mistake, and to forgive yourself. Once you catch yourself that you're in a bad situation, you're part of a bad system, maybe you become aware that you're doing something that really runs counter to your values. And so the first step is really to let yourself off the hook, to acknowledge the fact and not get caught up in paralyzing self-blame. At least that's how I would interpret what he says here. His next point is, he says, I am mindful. He says, in many settings, smart people do dumb things because they fail to attend to key features in the words or actions of influence agents and fail to notice obvious situational clues. So mindfulness is part of this, becoming aware that, in fact, you are taking part in a bad setup. The next step is being willing to assume responsibilities. It says, I am responsible. Taking responsibility for one's decisions and actions puts the actor in the driver's seat, for better or for worse. And he goes on. He's got a paragraph or two about each of these. The next one was, I am me, the best I can be. It says, do not allow others to de-individuate you, to put you into a category, a box, a slot, to turn you into an object. Assert your individuality. Politely state your name and your credentials loud and clear. Insist on the same behavior in others. Make eye contact. And he goes on and on. In other words, fighting anonymity, establishing that you are an individual and an empowered individual. His next step says, I respect just authority, but rebel against unjust authority. He says, in every situation, work to distinguish between those in authority who, because of their expertise, wisdom, seniority, or special status, deserve respect, and the unjust authority figures who demand our obedience without having any substance. His next step is, I want group acceptance, but value my independence. About that, he says, the lure of acceptance into a desired social group is more powerful than that of the mythical golden ring in Lord of the Rings. The power of that desire for acceptance will make some people do almost anything to be accepted and to go even further to further extremes to avoid rejection by the group. And, of course, he goes on. So, again, that point was, I want group acceptance, but I value my independence. His next point in this 10-step program is, I will be more frame vigilant. By being frame vigilant, he's referring to the situational dynamics. What's that framework in which you are now embedded? He says about that, who makes the frame becomes the artist or the con artist. The way issues are framed is often more influential than the persuasive arguments within their boundaries. Moreover, effective frames can be seen not to be frames at all, just sound bites, visual images, slogans, and logos. And he goes on. The next point is, I will balance my time perspective. And what he talks about there is that when you're caught up in one of these situations, it's very easy to lose your perspective on time. And for in the intensity of the situation, you begin to think that this high-pressure situation, such as, let's say, you're a guard at Abu Ghraib, and that sort of becomes the whole picture, and you lose your frame of reference in regard to place and to time. His next point is, I will not sacrifice personal or civic freedoms for the illusion of security. Well, that certainly fits our situation today in terms of what we're doing abroad. We're supposedly fighting for freedom, but we're finding that our own freedoms here at home are being curtailed bit by bit. About this, Zimbardo says, the need for security is a powerful determinant of human behavior. What can be manipulated in, we can be manipulated into engaging in actions that are alien to us when faced with alleged threats to our security or the promise of security from danger. Remember weapons of mass destruction? Okay, his next point, and I guess this is the final one, number 10, I can oppose unjust systems. He says, individuals falter in the face of the intensity of the systems we've described, the military and prison systems, as well as those of gangs, cults, fraternities, corporations, and even dysfunctional families. But individual resistance, in concert with that of others of the same mind and resolve, can combine to make a difference. Now, another area that he goes to in talking about how we might resist these kinds of situational influences, he goes on to talk about heroism and to make the point that we need to hold up heroes more to ourselves and to our children, to young people. You know, we have these false heroes of athletes and movie stars and rock stars and so on. But these aren't, by and large, these aren't the people that will equip us with the moral fortitude, the strength to resist situations in which we're under pressure by authority to conform. And so he creates what he calls a taxonomy of heroism. It's very interesting. I'll just run you through some of the high points of it. He breaks it down into, I think, 12 kinds of heroes. And he's got the 12 subtypes of heroes. The first is military and other duty-bound physical risk heroes. And he cites Achilles, Medal of Honor recipients, and a couple names here I don't recognize. Then he's got one called civil heroes, non-duty-bound physical risk heroes, and he mentions here Carnegie heroes. I guess these are people who get the Carnegie Awards. Then he's number three is religious heroes, and there he cites Buddha, Muhammad, Saint Francis of Assisi, Mother Teresa. Then four is political religious figures, and he cites Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu. Number five are martyrs, and there he cites Jesus, Socrates, Joan of Arc, and others. Number six is political or military leaders, and there he cites, among others, Abraham Lincoln, Robert E. Lee, Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, Vaclav Havel. I don't know how to say his name right, but I think you know who I mean. Number seven, adventurer, explorer, discoverer type heroes. And there he cites Odysseus, Alexander the Great, Amelia Earhart, Yuri Gagarin. Eight is scientific discovery heroes such as Galileo, Edison, Madame Curie, Einstein. Number nine, he calls the Good Samaritan type of hero, Holocaust rescuers, Harriet Tubman, Albert Schweitzer, Richard Clark. Number 10, he has his odds beater, underdog type of heroes. And there he cites Horatio Alger, Helen Keller, Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks. For number 11, bureaucracy heroes. Did you think there could be bureaucracy heroes? These are people who are employed in large organizations and sometimes involved in controversial arguments within or between agencies, typically involving standing firm on a principle despite intense pressures. And he cites Louis Pasteur, Edward Tolman, and Barry Marshall in that category. And finally, the hero of whistleblowers. And here he lists a number of whistleblowers, and I don't recognize any of the names. Shame on me. So, as you heard me say in the interview, I think this is a terribly important book. I think of all the books that we've reviewed and all the books that I've recommended here, this might be the one that I would recommend most strongly, that I feel is most important for people to be armed with this information. And as I say, it's written in an informal way and also a very scholarly way with lots of references and so on. It is about 400 and some pages. It's well worth the investment, particularly if you're interested in psychology or you're interested in the kinds of issues that were raised here. And it would be wonderful if some kind of a film or a more condensed presentation were to come about. And certainly this podcast was an attempt in that direction. Oh, I just remembered something I wanted to share with you that stood out for me as an example of what he's talking about. It may seem like a trivial example. I don't know if you watch American Idol or if you're in another country. I know there are other versions of the Idol series. But a week or so ago, one of the contestants, Melinda, was asked to point to which of two groups of the remaining contestants, there were six or seven remaining, so there were two groups of three that were split to the side, and she was asked to choose which of those two groups of remaining contestants was the most likely to be voted off. And me and my family went, oh no, what a horrible situation to put her in, you know, with millions of people watching. What a horrible thing to ask her to do. But you know what she did? She responded to it by just sitting down on the floor and refusing on national TV with a lot of social pressure. And she refused to make that choice. And that struck me as noble. For that alone, I think she should win.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Okay, well, we're running a little long here, so I'm going to keep it pretty short and sweet. One thing that helps me to do that is we have no new additions to our Frapper map, and really have not much in the way of email to respond to either way, at least not written email, but we got some great recorded transitions, which I'll get to in just a moment. First, I want to acknowledge the support of our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. So remember, you can get great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Two items of possible interest to you. This past Sunday, I was interviewed by Are You Serious on his podcast, The Are You Serious Show. You might recall that I interviewed Are You Serious just a few episodes back on Timothy Leary. And this time, he interviewed me on his show, which is one of my favorites. And he interviewed me about the book that I co-authored on the Zodiac serial killer. So if you're all interested in hearing that, look for the Are You Serious show on iTunes. That's the letter R, the letter U, space S-I-R-I-U-S. I'll also try to remember to put a link to that on the show notes on our shows page on the website. Another little interesting item is that just today I got a call from an AM radio show in Los Angeles asking me if I would sit in from time to time as their psychologist commentator. Evidently, there's a father and daughter, a co-hosting team, that are at each other's throats quite a bit, and so they decided to bring in a psychologist to maybe help them smooth things out. So from time to time, they may ask me to call in and do a little consulting with them. So I'll keep you posted as that unfolds. I have no idea what I'm getting into there or how it's going to turn out. Now, you may recall in the last episode that I invited people to send in audio transitions, MP3 files, and that we would make it a bit of a contest, and that I would choose the best audio clip between now and June 1st, and whoever wins will get a copy of Warriors, Settlers, and Nomads. So if you want to record an MP3 file and send it to shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can click on the My Chingo button on our website and record it there, or you can leave a message on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, or use our message line at 206-888-2746. And let's listen to some samples of what's come in so far.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Brandy from Danville, Virginia, and I just listened to the two latest episodes. I love it. It's great. Keep up the great work. You're doing wonderful, wonderful things, and the topics just keep getting better and better. And hopefully I'll hear from you soon. Bye.
Well, hi there, Brandy in Danville, Virginia. Thanks so much for sending along that clip. And boy, I don't know how to get back to you, because when it gets sent to me, it comes through, I think you sent it through K7, and it comes from them, and I don't have a return email address for you, so that's why you haven't heard from me. Let's listen to another one.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Just wanted to speak to you in person. It's Tom here calling from London, England. I'm really enjoying the shrink wrap work, the website, the podcasts. It's real inspiring, and I just admire you for the work that you're doing, bringing psychology to the lay person and to the professional when they decide to tune in. I really enjoyed this last one with Terence Watts. He's close to me down here in the UK, so it was interesting to hear what he's been doing. I'm doing a similar thing. Maybe we can talk about that one day. I'd love to do that. But anyway, I just wanted to connect with you. I have sent an email in the past, but I just wanted to connect with you again to just let you know that Tom from London is still still listening, and I think you're great. Keep it up. Speak to you soon. Bye.
Tom from London, thanks so much for that. Sounds like you were, I don't know if you were in your car or an airplane or you had a fan going, but at any rate, I certainly do appreciate your message. Sounds like you might be a potential guest. If that's the case, let me know.
It's Jeff and Carl Jung saying, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Your thoughts on the show, Carl?
I think there will be a reaction. A great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Right on then. Take it away, Dr. Dave.
That one was from Jeff Stiles in Canada, and what a clever and creative use, folding in the words of Carl Jung himself there in his actual voice. Hey, thanks a lot, Jeff. You've set the bar pretty high there. So, folks, there's the challenge. Let's see you rise to it. Thanks again to Dr. Philip Zimbardo for the opportunity to interview him on his book, The Lucifer Effect. Our next show will be with a sports psychologist, which is something I've been promising for a long time. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Mm-hmm.